The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Tracy Jenkins, the Director of the Office of Career and Professional Development at the Law School, so thank you very much for coming. It's truly my pleasure to introduce our speaker this afternoon, and she in turn, I think, will introduce our panelists. Deborah Epstein Henry is the founder and president of FlexTime Lawyers, LLC, which is a national networking and consulting firm advising on work-life balance and the retention and promotion of women. Debbie has facilitated hundreds of programs to lawyers around the country, providing attendees with career guidance, networking opportunities, and information to affect change. Debbie has garnered extensive press coverage from a wide variety of media outlets, including the New York Times, NBC News, Nightly News with Brian Williams, and the National Law Journal. In a partnership with the New York City Bar, FlexTime Lawyers, LLC introduced in 2006 the Cheat Sheet, which is the ultimate guide to selecting, creating, and ensuring a woman-friendly employer. And I believe we have copies of the sheet for your review if you didn't receive one when you checked in. FlexTime Lawyers has also teamed up with Working Mother magazine to conduct a national survey and release an annual list of the best law firms for women. In addition, the company has released in 2007 a new work-life methodology called FACTS, and most recently in 2009, the organization launched with others a new initiative called Balanomics, which I hope I pronounced correctly and looking forward to hearing about, bringing work-life balance into the diversity discussion and making the economic link between work-life balance and employer profitability. So without further ado, I'm pleased to introduce Debbie today. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you, Tracy. I'm delighted to be here. And if I don't need the mic, if you guys can hear, I will probably prefer to walk around. Is that okay? Do you think you can? Can you hear me like this? Okay. If anybody can hear, just raise your hands, and we'll get to that. I'm delighted to be here. I love to speak to law students nationally, and I regularly do whenever I can. We really want this discussion to be interactive. What we're going to do is I'm going to share the findings from the Cheat Sheet as well as the Best Law Firms for Women Initiative, two initiatives I run. And then we're going to turn to the panel and hear from them. Each of the panelists today are from winning firms for the Best Law Firms for Women 2008 list. And they're going to share with us how they got on that list, what are their successes, what are their remaining challenges, things like that. But feel free to raise your hand throughout, and we'll have a cocktail reception following, so I hope you can stay for that as well. So I want to start with, and encourage the panel to turn around if you'd like, to talk about the Cheat Sheet just for a few minutes, and that is in your materials, and really, what was the origin of that and why? As somebody who's worked on work-life balance and women's issues for 10 years, I found that there were three areas where pressure points were really happening. One was competition among firms. Firms that were very similarly situated were competing on these issues, and that's been part of my mission, how to make work-life balance and women's issues a basis of competition among firms, as historically has been the case for salary or pro bono even. The second is clients, and clients increasingly are using diversity as a criteria for selecting outside counsel, both gender and racial diversity. And the third is just law firm lawyers themselves who are internal in firms working within their women's initiative to try to make the environment a bit better. But one area where I felt was really untapped was women law students. And I'll give you an example of that. 3 years ago, I was at a law school graduation, actually sitting on stage, I was going to give a diploma to somebody. And the valedictorian was a woman who got up and shared some remarks. And following her remarks, she sat back down. It was at Lincoln Center there in New York. There were hundreds and hundreds of attendees. And she was sitting in one of the first rows with the other graduates. And following her remarks, the dean of the law school called up all of the students, called up the five summa grads and said, you know, she's going to start with announcing the class with five summa grads. It happened to be that the four other summa grads were men, and the one valedictorian with the fifth summa grad was this woman. And they walked, these five summa grads walked to the foot of the stage, and I saw one of the men gesturing to the woman law student to say, you know, go ahead, you're first, you know, that kind of thing. And she just sort of shrugged and just kind of made a motion like, no, hey, you know, you go first. And so he shrugged back, walked on the stage, and the dean of the law school announced this guy as the first graduate of the class. And I was going to scream. I remember just like physically bracing myself on that stage, not run over and strangle this woman. And that was sort of how I developed the cheat sheet idea. And I shortly afterwards approached New York City Bar and said, we need to write a guide for women law students. Not because they're not smart and capable. They're incredibly smart and capable. They think all they need to do is be the worker bee. They don't know the other intangibles to success, and we've got to change that. The other thoughts about the cheat sheet was, let's empower women to work collectively. They are very powerful, as nearly half of law school graduates. This is a powerful tool to make change in the profession. Also, when we launched the cheat sheet, it ended up being a partnership with FlexTime Lawyers and the New York City Bar Association. We wanted to create an open dialogue. We released the cheat sheet with the forum, and we also wanted to create competition among legal employers and law schools. So what is it? What we did in the cheat sheet was we identified six areas where women stall. And you're going to see these areas as reminiscent in the Best Law Firms for Women initiative when we get to that in a minute. But here are the six areas, and these areas are the areas not about being talented, not about being smart. It's the six other intangibles, really five, where women historically stall. So one is just female representation. That's not really an area as much as it's just exemplary of women not doing well. But the other areas where women, the other intangibles to success that women don't think about as much, and that valedictorian was one great example of that, is partnership and advancement, leadership, business development and networking, mentoring, and flexibility. If you ask law firm lawyers, and we can following my remarks, are these areas that are important for success at a law firm? I think they'll all say absolutely. These are the things that you don't really learn about in law school. You just learn about doing the good work and getting the good skills. But these skills are critical to success. What we did in the cheat sheet is we created questions under each of those six subheadings that are indicia of whether a law firm is women-friendly, so that it's a tool that you can use when you're looking at different law firms to try to identify whether a law firm is women-friendly. Those areas I just pointed to, those six areas, end up becoming very important as I worked with Working Mother to develop a 400-question survey of how to be a best law firm for women. And we looked at those six areas very closely, and you'll see that. So what I want to share with you now is the strategy behind this Best Law Firms for Women initiative. The idea is really twofold. One is create competition as an instrument of change. Get law firms to compete, as I said before, on work-life balance and women's issues as they historically have done for salary or pro bono. What we did in that regard is we said, listen, please participate in our free survey. If you make the list of the best law firms for women, is that on?
Yeah, it
can
be on.
If you make that list, we will publicize it and you will be celebrated. If you don't make the list, then it's confidential that you applied. We want to maximize the incentive to participate. We also said we'll alphabetize the list because firms were saying, well, I don't want to be 49 on the list. So we said, we don't care. If you're on the list, you're on the list and we'll celebrate you. The other thing we said is we're going to outreach to everybody for those winners. We want firms to compete on this issue. So we send copies of the magazine where the list is published to the 100 top law schools in the country. And it happens to be that we send it the week that there's on-campus interviewing. So it's not coincidental. So that, you know, the question is in those interviews, ideally, are you on the list? If not, why? If yes, you know, congratulations. We send it out for another, through our listservs and through the Working Mother Magazine's network. The other key component to the survey is information and benchmarking. As somebody who's worked on these issues for 10 years, it frustrated me that I felt there was no, firms were poised and ready to start devoting resources to these issues. They don't even know their strengths and weaknesses. So part of participation in the survey is you get a free scorecard that says, this is where you ranked in all the key sections of the survey compared to your competitors, compared to the other applicants. And those firms that are interested can then purchase a much more exhaustive benchmarking report that really breaks down nitty-gritty almost on a question-by-question basis of where these firms ranked against their competitors on most of the questions in the survey in terms of, and they can break it down in terms of size of law firms or regions. So for the methodology, what we did was, I'm going to show you data now that is from the 2008 and the 2007 list. This is aggregate data of the 51 firms. And not every firm answered every question, but this is aggregate from what the firms answered. So we had 50 winning firms. On average, just to give you a sense, these are mostly large law firms. On average, the number of lawyers is 576. And the percentage of firms with two-tiered partnerships, CHACs, meaning equity and non-equity partners, is about 46%. You see also the geographic distribution. The largest concentration of winning firms was in New York, and then DC was second with 8 winning firms, in New York with 10. So, not surprisingly, like you remember from the cheat sheet, representation was the first big section of the survey, and I just want to give you a flavor for some of these issues. So we looked at the female equity partner representation as well as representation at the other levels. What you see is at the associate level, and by the way, the purple is for 2007 findings and the green is for 2008. So what you see is at the associate level, the representation of women is pretty much comparable. When you get to the equity partner level, that's where the differential is most acute. You have the national average. In our 2007 numbers, the average for our winning firms was 16% equity partners. And then for 2008, our numbers were at 19%. So you got to think about this for a minute. Women have comprised 40 to 50% of law school graduating classes for nearly 20 years. Yet we're still only 19% at the best firms, 19% of equity partners. That's really a big issue that we need to, as a profession, really address, because it's no longer a pipeline excuse. For years, people said, oh, it's just a pipeline issue. Women haven't been in the pipeline long enough. But women have been, because it's been about 20 years where they've had almost equal representation. The other thing we looked at in terms of representation was mothers and fathers. Firms have never gotten this question before. Well, what is your representation of mothers versus fathers? What you'll see here is that the gap is much greater when you look at the equity partner level versus associate level. What we're trying to get at here is it possible to be a mother as well, a successful mother and partner at a firm? And the numbers are different. So you see with the fathers, 85% of equity partners are fathers, where only 71% of equity partners are mothers. And these are, once again, among our winning firms. All the data you see here is among our winning firms. We looked at lateral equity partner hires and hires that of lawyers who are coming in at all different levels. And what you see is, once again, and these numbers, I mean, part of what I want to show you through these charts is that these numbers keep on repeating themselves. At the first-year associate level, you've got 48% of women coming in. So it's fairly, you know, it's almost equal. And then you get to the equity partner level, and this is recruiting in equity partners, and only 20% of those equity partners who are being brought into the firm are women. And these numbers are very comparable to the business development numbers we're going to get to in a little bit. But there's not the same opportunity to bring in these lawyers. They're not, women haven't excelled to the same levels. They don't have the same amount of portable business to get in to these law firms at the equity partner level. Just in terms of definitions, I just recently spoke to law school and I got this question. I want to make sure everybody's on the same page. When I use these terms, non-equity versus equity partner, equity partner is a lawyer who is sharing the profits of the firm, that they're not just an employee, but they have both, they're sharing the profits, so they have the economics that is, you know, they're making more money at the firm, but they also have voting power, so they have control over policy decisions at the firm. The non-equity partner does not share in the profits, so it's a much less influential position. We looked at reduced hour hires. We've gotten this question a lot, and so we added this for our 2008 survey. I'm using the term reduced hours rather than part-time, which I think is very much a misnomer. But reduced hours, what I mean by that, is lawyers who typically work about 60 to 80% of the required billables of a firm. Sometimes lawyers work a little less or a little bit more than that, but that's where I generally see that. So reduced hour hiring is very minimal. You see for first year male and females, only 1% are hired on a reduced hour basis. And then for lateral lawyer hires, when I say lateral, I mean anyone who's not a first year hire, it's at 5%. So these numbers are really very low. The second section of the survey that I want to talk about is family-friendly benefits and policies. And what you're going to see across the board is law firms, large law firms, are extremely generous in their policies, and something will be interesting in tracking these numbers for our next year survey. We're doing our 2009 survey. Are any of these benefits going to be less generous with the down market? It's be something interesting that we'll be looking at. But on average, among our winning firms, 14 weeks paid leave is something that's being granted. Now, this was up from 12 weeks the prior year. I'm sure you read in the press a lot of the big firms were going up to 18 weeks paid and things like that. So we expected this number to jump even more for our 2009 survey. Given the down market, we don't know if it will. But every time we ask a policy question at this survey, when we ask about what the policy of the firm is, we always follow it up with a usage question, because policies can mean nothing. It really is about usage or representation. So we see that with associates, on average, and among our winning firms, they took 16 weeks leave, which is very good. And this is actually, in comparison to other industries, much more impressive. In all of the work-life questions we ask, we always ask them in relation to men and in terms of women as well. So among our winning firms, 90% of the firms offer paid paternity leave, and 96% offer paid adoption leave. These numbers grew in the adoption area significantly between 2007 and 2008. But what I found really interesting in this is we looked at how much was offered and how much leave was used. And this is a considerable change from 1994 when I graduated from law school. The weeks of paternity leave was offered were 6 weeks in 2008, but the number of weeks that were actually used was at 3 weeks. This is really significant. Another thing that's significant is that 83% of the lawyer fathers with newborns use this paternity leave versus 62% in 2007. I find this really heartening. As an advocate on work-life issues, I think the more we can move work-life issues away from being just a mommy's issue, the more effective we'll be. And usage of paternity leave is one indicia of this issue moving away from just being a mommy's issue, which is critical. The one caveat I add to that is that paternity leave is a temporary situation, and the stigma for men to avail themselves of other work-life policies like reduced hours is still really very great. Backup childcare is also something that's been on the rise. Something that we've noticed is 28% of our firms have on-site or near-site childcare. 82% have emergency backup corporate childcare. That's when a firm typically will have a relationship with an outside company where if the school is not closed on a holiday like Veterans Day, but the firm is still open, you can bring your well children to that site. What's interesting is in our first year of the survey, we looked at not only these policies related to lawyers, but also staff. This area, emergency backup childcare, is one of the only areas where we found real equity between staff and lawyers, that same 82% rate is offered for both staff as well as lawyers. Emergency backup childcare at home, where you send a nanny to somebody's house, that kind of thing, that area is growing. We had 42% of firms having that in 2008. Once again, these sorts of benefits I expect will dwindle in our 2009 figures. On-ramps and off-ramps is a very hot area on work-life balance, and that's really addressing mostly women lawyers who've left the profession because of child rearing and then are trying to get back in. We found that in 2008, 24% of our women winning firms had programs to host and keep in touch with and identify and rehire reentry moms. The other area that's interesting is that 84% of our firms have phased retirement or transition programs. What I mean by that, and this is an interesting area too, is that we now have a very large percentage of the baby boomer generation who comprise law firm partners at 70%. And a lot of them are saying, you know what, maybe I'll retire differently. Maybe I won't just quit one day, but maybe I'll just work flexible or reduced hours for 5 to 10 years. So firms are increasingly looking at phased retirement programs. Now, even with the down market, it's more. These are lawyers who said, you know, now that my savings is cut in half, I may need to work for a longer period of time, but maybe not necessarily in the most conventional way. The third area of the survey is flexibility. This is a big piece of the survey for us. And I want to show you once again how policies at the firms are very good. There's very generous access to flexible work, and I just want to walk you through a few of these numbers. We look here at full-time flex time policies. What I mean by that is lawyers working full-time hours, getting paid a full-time salary, but regularly working outside the office. So many lawyers will, you know, come in late one day because they have a doctor's appointment or their kid has an event at school. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, let's say, a fifth-year associate who's billing 2,000 hours a year and every Wednesday and Friday works from home unless there's a pressing client or other matter. So I think this is a growing trend in the industry, and I think it's a trend that really does benefit women because I think they benefit from formalizing flexible policies. They're looking for more permission to leave and come and go, and men historically have not seemed to need that permission as much. So we're looking at that trend, and 36% of our winning firms had written full-time policies. That's a big change even from a year prior, and I think that number will grow. 96% of our firms have written reduced hour policies. And other areas that we're tracking, which are growing trends, are one is annualized hours. And what that is when lawyers work on a deal around the clock, and rather than being staffed on another deal right away, they may take a two-month reprieve before being staffed again. It's another way to have reduced hours, and it's an area of interest for some in the corporate deal context in particular, where they don't want to give up the quality of work, but at year's end, they want to average less hours. So maybe they'll bill like crazy until June, and then their deal closes, and they'll take off the summer with their kids, and then they'll start up again. Job shares is another area where we have 10% of the winning firms offering it, but we'll get to usage in a minute. It's very low. Job shares is a huge area of pushing for me in the law firm context. I really think that this is an area of growth for firms and opportunity, and they should seize it. You'll hear firms say, oh, we can't do job shares because we know client will pay for two lawyers to have the same information on a team. But my epiphany was we've accepted as a community that doctors in a traditional medical practice can step into each other's shoes when dealing with patients' lives. It's high time that lawyers can step into each other's shoes to deal with clients' legal problems. And there are very cost-effective ways to minimize transition costs to ensure that clients are not billed extra. And this is an area I'm really pushing with law firm clients. The other area is telecommuting. Here we're looking at full-time telecommuting. 62% of our winning firms allow that. A lot of firms have part-time telecommuting. Now we'll look at usage. This is one of my more depressing slides, so I'll try to go through it fast. But you look at usage rates, so 9.5% of the winning firm lawyers use the full-time flex time policy. 7.6% use our working reduced hours. In our best law firms for women aggregate numbers, we always try to beat the national benchmarks where they exist. So NALP, the National Association for Law Placement, tracks usage of reduced hours on an annual basis. Their national average is 5.5% reduced hours. Ours is almost at 8%. That's important to us to see that our winning firms are doing that. Job sharing, 0.1% of our winning firms have lawyers using it, and full-time telecommuting, 0.9%. So this slide really says it all, that a lot of the challenge in the profession really is breathing life into the policies that really already exist. You see that life being breathed in with parental leave policies, which are these temporary policies, but when you talk about more permanent work-life policies, that's where you see the real gap. This is just another slide that talks about the low usage rates for reduced hours. And you look at it and you break it down in different ways. And what we did in this slide is compared our best law firms numbers to NALP. And you see that, as I said before, so NALP has 5.4% usage rates of reduced hour policies. And this kind of just goes through it in a more nitty-gritty way. There has been a lot of concern as that counsel position has grown at law firms that it's a real mommy-tracked position. And I think this slide really demonstrates how you see usage rate being so high in the reduced hour context with the counsel position. At our for our 2008 numbers, 21.9% of lawyers who work in that counsel position are working reduced hours. We also look at advancement rates for reduced hour lawyers. So it's like a usage question, but it also says, okay, well, are these lawyers actually being treated the same way? And one thing I want to point out is promotion is such a big sticking point with reduced hour lawyers. So over the past 5 years, we found that an average of 3 associates and counsel per firm had been elevated to non-equity or equity partner after working reduced hours. without requiring their return to a full-time consideration. So a long time ago, it used to be at the big firms that if you were a reduced hour lawyer and you wanted to be elevated to partner, you had to go back to a full-time status for 2 years before being considered. Now there's much more, it's much more standard at firms. In fact, 100% of our winning firms require or allow reduced hour lawyers to be elevated to at least non-equity partner, but you see the rate at these promotions is still exceedingly slow. This fourth section of the survey is about leadership, compensation, and advancement of women. So just to give you a sense once again about the survey, when we look at the work-life issues, we're looking at them related to men and to women. And then the rest of the survey is drilling down into those other areas I talked about with the cheat sheet where women stall. So leadership, compensation, advancement, mentoring, business development, all these other intangibles that valedictorian was not thinking about when she just said, oh, go ahead, I'm just smart, that's all I need to be. I think this is a really telling slide as well. This talks about the representation of women as leaders at our winning firms. So 6% of our winning firms had women who were chairpersons. 18% had women who were managing partners of the whole firm. And we then took what we believe to be the two most influential committees at firms. One is the management committee, and the other is the compensation committee. In our 2009 survey, we also are looking at the partner recommendation committee, those who are lawyers on the committee who decide who becomes a partner, because we think that's also really important. But you see the representation on these committees is still hovering around the same number where women represent the equity partner rents, which is 18% for the management committee and 19% for the compensation committee. Until representation of women changes in these leadership roles, we're not going to see the same change in representation in general. This was something new we looked at for 2008, which I thought was really instructive, was we not only looked at representation of women at the equity partner rates, but we looked at a history of what was happening the 5 years prior, because when we're looking and analyzing whether firms should be on the list or not, we not only want to hold them accountable for, well, what's your current representation of women, but also in the next 5 years, in terms of the promotion rates, are they much higher to show you're moving in the right direction? So among our winning firms, we found that of those who were being promoted to equity partner over a five-year span, 33% were women. And I mentioned before that our equity partner number was at 19%. So clearly these firms are moving in the right direction, but it's one more indicia of whether things are really going the way we'd like them to go. Excuse me, 33% is the non-equity promotion rate. The equity promotion rate is 29%. Compensation is another huge area to look at in terms of women and whether they're doing well. And these numbers are actually not percentages. These are raw numbers. We found that, once again, these are firms that are on average 576 lawyers, that the average number of women partners per firm who are among the top 10% of the most highly compensated lawyers at the firm, 4 women lawyers. And you looked at that same question, the top 5% of the most highly compensated lawyers in the firm, 1 woman lawyer on average. These are staggering numbers that really tell a very compelling story. Before I get to the last section of the survey, I'm throwing a lot of data at you, and we're going to really bring the data to life through the panel in a minute. I just want to see if there are any questions so far. I don't want to have, like, stunned silence. That's not a good thing. So in this last section, we're looking at development and retention of women. This is more along lines of training and mentoring and things like that. You're going to see again, like you saw with the policies, that this is really generous. And my partner in this initiative, Working Mother, looks at these same issues in other industries and says there isn't, interestingly, they're just not as generous in terms of the offerings, but usage is higher a lot of the time. So 58% of our winning firms have management or leadership training for all lawyers, and 62% provide management or leadership training targeted to women lawyers in particular. In terms of networking, 98% of firms hold business development and networking training for lawyers, and they have 66% have budget targeted for women lawyers in terms of business development. So what you're seeing here, and this is important when you're interviewing with firms, if a firm says, oh, and we do business development training for women, to have a context to it. On my website, you can download these statistics, and you can have them handy to see, okay, is this distinguishable about a firm? Be smarter about selecting them to know what is really distinguishable. Mentoring is another big area for women as well, and 80% of our winning firms have formal mentoring programs for all lawyers, and then 72% have what's called mentoring circles. Mentoring circles is a fairly new trend with firms that has been helpful, particularly for women and people of color, and what it does is it has groups of women who, rather than just a typical mentor and mentee pair, you have groups of women meeting together on a regular basis, and there's more opportunity for sort of a natural connection. Also, 68% of our firms have mentoring targeted for more senior women associates and newly admitted partners to sort of get them through that transition and ideally make sure that they make that transition. And the last thing that we looked at here is women and work-life initiatives. What we found is that 92% of our winning firms in 2008 have these women's initiatives, and 62% have work-life initiatives, and 22% offer some sort of internal rewards for significant contributions to women's issues. So once again, if you're interviewing with a firm and they talk about a women's initiative and the firm has one, it's pretty standard at the big firms that they exist. Once again, you really want to look and drill down more into, you know, representation of women, usage of policies, and things like that, as opposed to just having the policy in place and that sort of thing. Affinity groups, once again, is one other area where we looked at across the board. And like with women's initiatives, these affinity groups, which are groups of lawyers who have similar backgrounds meeting on a regular basis, this is really a common trend in firms. 86% of our winning firms have these affinity groups for women, 80% for lawyers of color, and 58% for LGBT lawyers. So, those are a lot of statistics. It's really meant to just give you just kind of a snapshot of what's going on with these winning firms in these areas. And now really what I want to do is start with our panel and get a much better sense of what's going on with these numbers and what they really mean. I'll just pause for a second and see if there are any other questions on the data. I know I threw a lot at you before we get started with the panel. I also want to recognize that we've got a man in the room, which I always am delighted. I really think that firms that are progressive on women's issues, it's usually exemplary that they're progressive on other issues. And as I've mentioned, on the work-life piece, the issues we're looking at are gender, you know, are gender neutral. The other thing that's exciting to me along these lines is that with Gen Y and law students who are coming from Generation Y, I'm seeing much less distinction between men and women on these issues. And as I said before, the more we can move this away from just being a mommy's issue, the better off we'll be. So I'm really heartened to see men in the room all the time, and I didn't say that to embarrass you. But I think the more I hear male law students asking the right questions, coming to these kinds of programs, the more encouraged I am, because I think that's going to force change even more, because we can't afford to operate with no lawyers. You know, now it used to be half the lawyers who were entering the profession, you know, were a lot of them articulating these issues. So I'm going to start with Sarah, actually. She graduated from American University Washington College of Law in 2003 and has been working as an associate at Aaron Fox since graduation. She worked in the advertising and intellectual property groups at her firm and acts outside counsel for the estate of Albert Einstein, Google, Sony, PlayStation, LG Electronics, and Discovery Channel. She has 1 2-year-old son, another baby on the way, and she switched to an 85% schedule at her firm last year and will likely stay at this level for, as she put it, as long as she can manage. Sarah, I want to start with the promotion rates at Aaron Fox, and that was one thing that was distinguishable about the firm getting on the list, is that our national average, our best law firm's average was at 29%, and your firm has, in the past 5 years, promoted women at a 33% rate. Just as an example, is that something that you see as a strong point about the firm, and is that something that's distinguishable, and if so, why?
Oh, absolutely. I'm a perfect example because I'm 85%, and at the time I was almost a fifth year associate when I made the decision, which is kind of a crucial time to be making a decision to cut back on your work and just when partnership starts to become more of a pressing issue. And I had meetings with a female partner who's my mentor and said, you know, I'm not going to do this if I'm, you know, going to lose the chance of being a partner. And everyone that I met with, a female and a male partner, both acting as mentors to me, looked at me like, you're crazy to even consider that this would affect your chance of being partnership. That's not what we're even going to be looking at. You know, your quality of work is more important than how much face time you have at the office. And they've fully supported me having a flexible schedule. And it's not just me. I've seen, once I broached the subject with people, I had women, you know, coming to me, talk to me about it, other female partners at the office who were on flex time, who I didn't even know were, because you communicate so much via email now and on the telephone, that I didn't even realize that there was this group of women who were flex time, who were very supportive. So I haven't had any issue, frankly, going to 85%. I feel like I haven't sacrificed my career at all yet. We'll see.
Do you feel like there's something, you know, the firm is actively engaged in looking at talented female associates at around that pivotal time, around the fifth year, and identifying, you know, are they getting the requisite amount of experience to advance,
right,
and are they getting exposure to the influential partners to advance to ensure that those promotion rates continue to increase?
Yes. I think we, especially in the past, I'd say 2 or 3 years, I think it's gotten even more so. I think they've realized that this is a change. Aaron Fox has always been known to have a very balanced work-life balance. They've strived to have this friendly, family-oriented atmosphere, but I think at least in the last 5 years, they've realized that one of the things they have to do is offer women a more flexible schedule and support it. And like I said, I think that I've noticed, when my first year class, it was the first class ever at Aaron Fox to be all women. It was 15 women, and a handful of us were actually from AU. So it was a great, for us, there's probably 8 of us left still that are there. And so we're all working together, and 2 of us have become mothers. So it's, yeah, absolutely. I think the firm has continued to support that. So
great. Maria Luisa, I want to turn to you. Maria Luisa Galazzi is a partner in the Insurance Coverage and Food and Drug Practices Group of Covington & Burling. Her insurance advisory practice focuses on negotiating settlements of insurance coverage disputes, advising policyholders, negotiating and analyzing terms of policies, and representing policyholders. She is a managing partner for legal personnel at the firm with responsibility for associate issues. She served as an associate ombudsperson and co-chaired the summer associate program from 2004 to 2006. She received her JD from NYU School of Law and her BA from Harvard University, cum laude. Maria Luisa, Covington's numbers in terms of equity partners are really very high for large law firms. Our best law firm's average is at 19%, the national average is at 16%, and Covington's at 21%. And I want you to talk a little bit about how you think the firm has been more successful at achieving a higher representation of women. 21% is not where we all want to be ultimately, but it's certainly above the curve. And I want to get a little better sense of how it's achieving that.
I will add one interesting factoid to my bio there. I'm also a single mom. So there are many models in the full, and I work full time. So there are lots of ways to do this, and you should explore them all. I've been thinking about that, and the women partners, we have only a single-tier partnership. We don't have a non-equity partnership. And we get together for a monthly lunch, which was sort of started on our own. It was not an officially sanctioned event. And we all sort of keenly watch the progress of the younger women lawyers coming up through the firm. And I think you'll get to this issue later about challenges that we face, but because of the way you have a sort of disproportionate or proportionate number of female associates now, but a proportionately smaller number of partners, you have a consistent lack of available role models, I think particularly in litigation, and demands that are heavily placed on the people who are in those positions. We now have 2 of 7 partners on our management committee are female. But many of the senior women lawyers in the firm, like me, have held, you know, every job there is going. I think the community of the senior women lawyers, and we all remember the days of, you know, floppy bow ties and sort of mannish-looking suits that one was obliged to wear, are sort of very conscious of gender issues, and I think more so than some of the lawyers who are coming in now, much to my astonishment, because a lot of the people of your vintage sort of come in like, you know, gender issues, what gender issues? We're 50-50. There isn't a gender issue, and there are, and they're more subtle than they used to be. I think some of the success of women lawyers in the firm is mentoring in particularly smaller practice groups. One of the very best mentors is a very senior male lawyer who has really brought some female lawyers under his watch along, and he's just stunning. But there are a lot of lawyers who find it difficult to mentor across gender differences or racial differences. And so that is not as much of the norm as it should be. I think part of the success is that the firm has its eye on these issues, and we are more consciously adjusting assignment systems and mentoring systems and watching the promotion of women. And we have a very talented group of people coming up. So our 2007 class, if I'm not mistaken, we had six in Washington, of which 50% were women. So I don't know that I can attribute it to any one factor. I think it's this constellation of effort that's coming from a lot of different sources and the institutional will to make it happen. But it's a slow process. I mean, we've been watching it for 20 years. It's slow.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that you brought out, which I'm glad you did, I mean, several things, but this notion of incoming lawyers not recognizing there's any issue, and when we wrote the cheat sheet over the summer, we had the president of every women's law association in all the New York City law schools be part of a focus group, because the last thing I wanted to do was write a guide for women law students and just miss the mark. And we talked about different issues, and one of the issues that came up that summer was women saying, you know, why are you writing this guide for us? Aren't you just kind of pointing the finger at us? And everything seems fine to us. And we said, you know, that's kind of the point, is that we want to work with women when they're in a position of strength, when they don't see the issues, because that gap, and that's why I always turn to the statistics, that gap of 50% at graduation and 16% at the equity partner level shows that those issues are still going on, and really to get an understanding of them, you want to ideally come in with much greater awareness. I think your point about bringing in men to the discussion is critical, is that, you know, we are not going to be effective if we just try to do this on our own. There's some men who've been fantastic, and they can be wonderful role models too, because you can't put all the pressure on those women at the top to do it all, because they'll be leaving too if that's the case.
Well, I think one important thing that your slide show of is that a lot of power in law firms is concentrated in male hands at this point. So if you're only looking to the women to be the mentors and to be the, you know, the rainmakers and things like that, there is a whole slew of mentors and people like that that these young women associates are not going to have access to. So you have to sort of reach across that divide somehow.
Absolutely. Terrific. I want to turn to you, Maureen, and this is Maureen Jeffries, and she's a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Arnold & Porter. She received her J.D. from American University in 2000 and her B.A. in journalism from American University in 1996. She provides regulatory transactional litigation counseling to wireline, wireless, cable television, media, and internet clients. She's also co-author of the annual publication Recent Developments in Cable Law. So Arnold & Porter has really had a historic, been historically acknowledged as being really positive on the family-friendly front. And in your reduced hour lawyers representation, it's very evident. The national average is 5.4%, our average is 8%, and your average for reduced hour lawyers is at 10%. And if you could talk a little bit about the firm's family-friendly philosophy, how it's been ingrained, and how it's been successful, that would be great.
Sure. Let me just add to my own bio that I have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old. I have not gone to a reduced hour schedule. I work full-time, but I do, you know, there is some flexibility, and when I work, I go home, I try to tuck my kids in at night and then get back on the computer if I need to. And I think that one of the things in my group when I became a mom was that everyone realized it's important that I'm not going to be in the office at a certain hour unless they, you know, if they need me to, you know, I said sort of at the beginning, if you need me to be here, I'll be here. But otherwise, I will, you know, take a break, I'll go home, and I will resume work if I need to from my house. And that's one thing that's very nice now is that everyone's connected. You can get on the network from your house and do your work. And as Sarah said, you know, you don't need to be in your office to be productive. So that's been my experience in terms of the flexibility of my own schedule, even though I'm full-time. But many female lawyers at my firm opt for a part-time or reduced hour schedule. We call it flex time because, you know, you're not always working that. You're still working quite a bit. But we have, it really is, it's also called a flex schedule because it's not just a set schedule. You will work, you know, 4 days a week from 9 to 5. It's really something that each individual figures out what is going to work best for them, and then works with the management of the firm to determine if that's going to work with their group and the demands of their practice. So everyone sort of, you know, sculpts their own schedule to make it work for them and for the practice. We also have a part-time, I think we have two part-time partners who serve as sort of mentors or counselors to associates who are thinking about going part-time or who have gone to a flex schedule. And those partners lead regular lunches where we have sort of an agenda set throughout the year of lunches, topics that are of interest to part-time attorneys throughout the firm, and every office hosts the lunches and has speakers or written questions to address at these lunches. We also have ombudspersons that attorneys can go to talk about confidential issues. And then just a couple of other things I don't want to rattle on. But we, in 2007, we formalized an on-ramp, off-ramp program that Deborah mentioned, which is just something that we had going informally for years where attorneys would take an extended leave from the firm, often to care for young children, and then they'd want to come back. And this was just a policy that we formalized to recognize that many, attorneys want to do that. And then the last thing I'll just mention is something that we sort of are historically known for is our child care center, which is on site in the building, and that allows parents to enroll their children there, but also it's for backup daycare. So if my daughter was there for 2 years, and then when my son was born, we hired a nanny. But if my nanny's not available, then we're able to arrange to have my kids in the backup daycare center. And so that's a nice option that helps parents with their, keep their schedules and deal with their child care needs as well.
Great. I want to pick up on two things. One is that notion of having a point person in charge of the lawyers working flexible or reduced hours has really been a key point for firms that have had successes in these areas. To have somebody accountable who's mostly looking at hours, whether the person's exceeding their hours, and also on a regular basis, a lot of times you do exceed your hours, but whether they're really disproportionate. And the other thing is whether they're still getting access to the good work. So those point people are really critical, and they're called different things at different places, but the mentoring too really helps to minimize isolation. The other point I just want to bring up is that issue of formalizing these reentry programs. That's a trend that I'm seeing across the country, and it's something that is really important. There was a study done that found that 43% of women lawyers leave the profession independent of maternity leave at some point in their careers. Those are really high numbers. So to address that formally is a great thing. I want to turn to Maria O'Toole Jones, and then I'm going to go to Tracy Weir also, and ask you both about leadership. And let me start with Maria. She's a member at Miller and Chevalier. She practices in the area of federal tax with a focus on tax controversy and the taxation of insurance companies. She spends most of her time fighting with the IRS and the Department of Justice. She has been with the firm for 11 years and practiced with another DC firm for 5 years prior to that. She made Equity Member, which is their equivalent of Equity Partner, in 2001 while working on a reduced schedule. She received her LLM in tax with distinction from Georgetown, a JD from the George Washington University Law School with honors, and a BS from the University of Delaware, cum laude. She's got a 10-year-old daughter and a 6-year-old son. So, Maria, the firm has been really distinguishable in terms of its leadership, and I know that's something that really appealed to us in looking at your application. You've got the chairperson of the firm, who is a woman, and women leading half the firm's committees, and two serving on the 6-person executive committee. And you could talk a little bit about whether those steps were deliberate, how it's evolved, how it set a tone. That would be great.
It's definitely been a slow progress to get here. And, you know, when I started at the firm, it was pretty much all men were running the firm. And that's typical in, you know, well-established Washington law firms are full of, hate to say it, but old white guys. And, you know, things are changing and we're getting there, but it takes a while. So and over the years, we've changed the structure of the executive committee at the firm as well. And it came to a point where the executive committee was made up of the heads of each of the departments. And it just so happened that the heads of each of the departments were men, because that's just the way it was. And finally, we decided that we needed some women representation on the executive committee, because these guys just can't think without some perspective and some diversity in their thinking. So we created this thing called it was like the ad hoc member of the XCOM initially. And, you know, we called it the chick slot for a while, because it was, you know, basically we need a woman and there's not really a natural role, so we'll just create one and put a woman on the executive committee to help these guys out. Well, by doing that, I think, you know, the women who were in the chick slot, you know, the one actually is now the chair of our tax department. So she's in the executive committee now, in a normal role, and not, we don't need the chick slot anymore. And, you know, over time, our current chair is Mariana Dyson, and Mariana just sort of was the natural person to fall in as our managing partner. And that was sort of just, it happened. So I think it's been a little bit of everything in kind of getting women into those positions. I do want to pick up a little bit on Maria Louise's point about sort of the committees and the leadership on the committees, because it's a little bit of a double-edged sword. I mean, there are only so many women to go around. You see the percentages, but you want the women to be represented on committees, but then you end up doing too much of it. So, you know, if you need a woman on every committee, the women tend to be doing too much of the non-billable work, which sometimes is not valued as much as the other work. So that's a real tension, and something that only, it'll improve with time, with more women in the equity partnership and the equity membership. But I think that's been a real challenge. And I think one of the things, you know, mentoring is critical. I think, you know, and the more women who are rising into these positions and can help give guidance to the younger women who are trying to figure out what positions should I take or what positions should I strive for, you know, you learn a lot. You know, I clearly remember somebody coming to my door and saying, "Will you be the chair of the social committee?" And I'm like, "No." You know, like, I am going to say no to something, because, you know, the natural inclination is like, "Of course, you know, we're here, we help the firm." And I'm like, "This is going to do nothing for me." You know, so, you know, at some point you need to learn to strike a balance and learn to say no to things.
Right. I think that tension that both of you raised about women having to do everything, these women partners mentor and lead and do all these things, I mean, I think some of it could be controlled by changing the model a little bit, having more co-chairs of departments and things like that, so they could, you know, job share the leadership roles in addition to, you know, so they could have more of a presence but not carry all the burden. And I think that's, I'm seeing some firms do that as a way to have the women be present but not have them carry all the work. Tracy Weir is an associate at Hogan & Hartson. Her practice is primarily devoted to health, antitrust, and consumer protection matters. She provides firm clients with counseling and representation on an array of competition, privacy, and healthcare regulatory issues. She received her JD cum laude from American University, Washington College of Law, and her BA with honors from Purdue University. In law school, she served as an associate managing editor of the American University Law Review and was a Dean's Fellow in the Legal Methods Program. I want to talk to you, Tracy, also about leadership and get a different perspective on, you know, what's going right at Hogan Hartson in that regard, because you've also, as a firm, had a lot of success in that area.
Sure. Well, I think Hogan, I think Hogan has been one of the leaders, to one of the first firms in D.C. to sort of achieve a critical mass of women in the firm, and then promoting those women to leadership roles. And I think some of the things that the firm has done that really help to make that happen are the firm instituted a 2 billable hour track, which you can choose as an associate coming in to bill 1,800 hours or 1,950. And I can tell you that that is no small thing. It's 150 hours, but giving you the option to say, you know, I choose to bill 1,800 hours or to have that be my goal, gives you a tremendous amount of flexibility. And I think it gives women in particular some flexibility to not necessarily make this choice of, you know, I've had a child, I'm going to go reduced hours. You could still be full-time and choose a lower billable hour goal. Another thing that I think has supported women getting into leadership positions at the firm is that a lot of the women, the successful women who have made it to equity partner and other partner, non-equity partner, I still consider that successful, are really the type of women who are mentors. And I can tell you from my own experience that when I first came into the firm as a first year, one woman in particular in the antitrust group really took me and almost all the other women who came into the firm under her wing, and were a little bit devastated because she's probably leaving to a government position. We were all just emailing each other today about how devastated we are. But it's just the point is that there are women who are in these roles, and they recognize the need to mentor, and they themselves were mentored by others, women, and probably men as well, those initial women making it into leadership positions. So I think those are some critical things.
Terrific. I have a few questions. I'm actually a big advocate of those multiple tracks. And what I'm trying to push is having those, let's say, 2 or 3 tracks, but then also having reduced hour lawyers on those tracks as well. So it's not called a separate part-time program. I'm just wondering, was there ever a discussion that you're aware of about that, rather than having sort of 2 full-time tracks and then reduced hour tracks, just having, I recommend, you know, 3 to 5 tracks, period.
You know, I have not heard that at Hogan. I haven't heard that.
And then the question also is, what are the promotion rates of those 2 different tracks? Are they the same period of time?
You mean 1800, 1950? Yeah, I don't, you know, my experience and what I've seen is that it really does not make a difference. To be honest, the real difference is it's probably practice specific. More corporate groups tend to be more on the 1950 track versus regulatory groups tend to have more of the 1800, people who have chosen the 1800 track. And partnership decisions are made by the firm, but they're also, people are supported by people within their own groups. And so it's sort of like a mini, you know, within the big firm, there are these many groups that support you. And, you know, if 1800 is the accepted track in that group, then it's not going to be an issue for partnership. And I frankly don't think it's an issue in the other groups either. I haven't seen it to be an issue, I should say that.
And so it sounds like you're seeing less of people changing their tracks from year to year. It's kind of like if they go with 1800, they seem to stay in that.
I think that's right. I think it's a personal decision that you make when you come in. I mean, the truth is that, you know, I've always been an 1800 person because my own, you know, way that I want to live is I don't want to have that extra stress of, oh my gosh, what if there's not the work? I can't meet 1950. And I think, you know, and if I make 1950, I'll get paid at the end of the year for that. And so, you know, I'll put the risk on the firm on that side. And so I think people who make those decisions make them on those kinds of bases you know, as opposed to others.
Great. I want to open up to questions and hear from some of you, and I will not accept people who are shy, so I'll just have to walk right up to you if you want to ask the question. Yes.
So I was a paralegal for a few years, and it kind of made deciding to go to law school a little tricky, so I was like, wow, I still don't want to end up there.
You won't say where you worked, of course.
Yeah. No. But so, and you know, admittedly, like, two of the four interviewers said, how do you feel about overtime when I was interviewing? So it's not like they were hiding necessarily, although which I really appreciate it fully. So I guess I'm just wondering, like, do you have suggestions on, but then I don't feel like I could walk into an interview and be like, so how scary of a lifestyle do you have? So, like,
who wants to start with that?
I'll take it. I think you can ask the question delicately. You know, when you're at lunch with the associates, ask what their lives are like. Ask, you know, I mean, in our firm, nobody's there on the weekends. You know, and part of it is because we've all accepted this flex time way of living. You know, if you do work, you tend to do it at home or at night, or, you know, so it's not a FaceTime firm. And I think you can figure that out. Although I have to believe that most firms are getting to the point now where there's less of this FaceTime, but I don't think that's true universally. So I think, you know, when you're asked, you know, what time do you usually go home at night? You know, or what kinds of things do you do? And if they start saying, well, sometimes I go out with friends, but often I have to cancel because I can't get out of work, then that's a sign that, you know, it may be a little bit crazy. So, you know, I think there are ways to kind of understand, you know, do they have a life outside of just being an associate?
I would just add to that I think it's a great question, and two things. I think that's a great question, but I think you should ask it of every single person that you meet with, because sometimes it's not necessarily the firm, it's the person who doesn't know how to draw boundaries, and I'm certainly guilty of having that problem. The second thing is, I have been on the recruitment committee at Hogan for a couple of years now and interview a lot of folks coming through, and I can tell you that people ask the work-life balance question all the time. And, you know, I don't know how that will change this coming year because of the economic situation. People will be more hesitant to ask that, but I've never been put off by somebody asking that question, because, to be honest, Hogan bills itself as a firm that values work-life balance, so if we're putting ourselves out there for that, you should feel free to ask the question.
I was just going to add, we have a recruitment website, and I'm sure other firms do too, where we have testimonials from a couple dozen attorneys, and, you know, it's on what their practice is like, what they do in their free time, you know, a number of things. So you may be able to just go on to some websites and do a little you know, pre-interview research and figure out a lot of the questions just from looking at the firm's own information.
Yeah, I mean, Tracy's point also is important, because when you're looking at the work-life equation, it's not just about it's multiple factors. It's the nature of the practice as such, which is sometimes really crazy, that nobody can control because the client or the work has to get done. The other areas are more important. Like Tracy said, you want to ask the individual, because different individuals, because some people are more effective at managing their time. What you're trying to really get at more than anything is the environment as hospitable as it can be given the nature of the practice? That's a different issue, and it's whether a partner lets a complaint sit on his or her desk for 18 days before giving it to the associate to turn around in 2 days. That's what you're trying to get at. If you look at the cheat sheet, there's a series of questions under the flexibility that will give you some questions to think about. There's also a resource section where it's every website we could conceivably think of in 2006 that deals with these sorts of issues, so that may be a helpful resource as well. Other questions? Tracy.
I'm just curious if the panelists can address this issue of when flexibility is available. So for example, a lot of our students will come and say, you know, I'm going to go to a firm immediately and just work 60%. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times we're trying to explain to them that you really need to go in, you need to work, and then just sort of prove your worth. And then if the policy is available, then
Well, I can answer that just because we actually had a first year who went to 80% status. It was a female who just came in, and she decided right off the bat she didn't like working as much as she was having to work at the time, and so she switched to 80%. And I remember, as like at the time I was a third year, hearing that and being shocked, but also very impressed that she was able to go. She went and worked it out with all of the people that she worked with and was able to switch to 80%. She's still at the firm, and I think she's she's a fourth year now and still 80%. And the firm encourages it, I think, because for the reasons that you were mentioning earlier, it works to have a flex time schedule. You're not paying that person as much. They're happy. They feel lucky to be in that position. So, I would encourage people to at least prove themselves somewhat. I mean, she had worked probably 6 months and had established that we want to keep her. So prove yourself a little bit, but don't be afraid to also, you know, ask the questions of the appropriate people as soon as you're ready.
Can I offer a somewhat contrary view? I think I agree with you on the notion that it makes sense to go in and prove yourself, and maybe that can be done in 6 months, and you go in and people know you're a superstar and so forth. I mean, people at our firm can certainly do reduce schedules or flex schedules for a variety of different reasons. It's not just because you're a parent. But when you go into a firm, or any workplace for that matter, but what I know best is a firm, you need to get to know the place, the culture, the people. You need to form relationships with mentors. You need to learn your stuff. And so I would think that the best time to make that investment is when you walk in the door. And then maybe you want to sort of work a little bit more on balancing and things like that. So I would be very judicious in sort of walking in but not wanting to do 100% on the first day of work. I think that's something that you should think carefully about. And the first day of work, the first year of work, maybe time to spend your time less focused on balance and maybe more on getting your arms around this community you've just become part of.
I think that our numbers reflect in our survey, that one slide I showed, 1% of our winning firms have lawyers coming in, reduced hours at the entry level. I think most of the firms have in their policies that it's discretionary, and if there's an opportunity like there was with this candidate who's really good and it worked out. But it's atypical. I mean, I think that what you really want to do to negotiate flexibility is you want to be fantastic. The best way to negotiate getting those arrangements is to be talented and to be somebody the firm wants to retain and promote. And usually it does take 6 months, you know, more than 6 months to prove that. That's your best negotiating power, is to be good. And so to the extent that you can garner that goodwill, I mean, my experience in dealing with these issues, it's typically third, fourth, and fifth years who are around the stage where they start asking for reduced hours. Other questions? Yes.
I have been doing other things besides law.
With what?
I'm wondering if you think that the entry possibility, but in my case, I applied to some law firms.
So the question is really, you know, would a law firm be interested in a candidate who's done something different other than law for a period of time? Who would like to start with that?
Well, we actually probably in the last couple of years have formalized a senior attorney position, and it's really for people who have been doing other things and then come back to a law firm, and they're not, it's not quite right for them to be, come in as a partner or counsel, and so they come in as a senior attorney. And so I think, I think that was something that we would do in a, you know, small number of cases.
Tracy, were you going to add?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, I mean, we routinely look at people's resumes, and
I would say more often than not, it's well, I mean, certainly we have people who have gone straight through, you know, from college to law school and then to the firm, but I would say a lot of folks that we look at have other experiences, you know, be it military experience or whatever, and so it's a little bit of a different answer to the question you're asking is a little bit different than the one I'm answering, but I think that it can only add value the more experience you have.
Other questions? You know, I'm going to call on you in the purple sweater. I don't think I'm going to let you down. Should I give you, we have a question in the back. I'm going to give you a few minutes to think about your question. Okay? Go ahead.
I was just curious if where applicable the panels would speak about the mentoring programs at each firm and if they've used them or if they themselves have served as mentors to younger females, whether it's
do you want to start? We'll go down the line. I think you want to hear from each of the firms about that.
Yeah, I would guess that all of us have mentoring programs, and we usually have brand new lawyers come in, and they are mentored by another associate who is sort of closer in age and I think closer to the experience of being a new lawyer. And then as they get more senior, they pick up and formally assigned mentors who are partners. But there is also a lot of informal mentoring, particularly within practice groups, that goes on. And those mentoring relationships, at least when people come in, usually last about 3 years total.
Yes, Aaron, we have a mentor program. I have a female partner as a mentor and also a male partner in a different practice area as a mentor. And I mean, it's great. I get a free lunch every 2 months and advice on partnership and also from the female partner, just advice on navigating the system and, you know, working with, she's a working mom. So advice as far as that goes as well. So it's been fantastic.
I'll just add a couple of things that haven't already been said. We have all of those things. I mentioned we've got, sort of ombudspersons, part-time partners, to whom people can go and talk about particular issues. We also have a program called Women Lawyers at Arnold and Porter, and it's a somewhat more informal mentoring program. We get together, I think, once a month for lunches. We have speakers. There are opportunities for both associates and partners to speak at the lunches. One time we read a book about, challenges of being promoted at for women being promoted at law firms, and we had a book discussion with groups of partners and associates. So there are a lot of informal opportunities as well.
Is that part of the Women's Initiative, or is that separate?
Well, it's Women Lawyers at Arnold and Porter, so it's a group, and I don't know if that's formally part of the Women's Initiative,
right.
It's an organized group. We have we have programs like once a month. We have we have a steering committee. We have an agenda for the year, and we've hosted some really excellent programs. We had one other one that I thought was great. We had general counsels from clients come in and talk to us about what what they find important in relationships with attorneys at firms. And there were, I think, three women and one man on the panel. That was a very good program, too, about things to think about as you're coming up in terms of developing relationships, working with clients.
Maria?
Yeah, we have a formal mentoring program. Each associate is assigned a partner, and that goes on for a year, and you can re-up with the same partner. Or we often encourage switching around so that you get the opportunity to develop relationships with different people each year. But in addition, I think the informal mentoring is what's really the most important. We have developed a women's group. It started informally, and one of our women associates actually came up with the idea, and we started a lunch group. But we've done such things as, there's a book that we read called, Why Women Don't Get the Corner Office or something.
That's the book.
Yeah,
that's the book.
Some of the things in it are, people had very strong opinions about whether it was right or wrong, but it was a great catalyst for discussion. And, you know, we sat around and we laughed, but some of it was so true. And, you know, I said, this book was worth reading even if you learned two things from it, you know. And some of it is just, you know, there are things that women by our very nature do that aren't great when you're trying to develop business or, you know, get ahead in a law firm. And you need to sort of be aware of those things. And I think that, you know, with women mentors, that it's a very helpful thing to try to learn to navigate some of these things. You know, I'll give you my favorite example is, you know, we tend to be more polite and we're always apologizing and, you know, sorry I'm late. Don't apologize. Just get it in and, you know, men wouldn't apologize for something. Or if you're on a conference call, you know, the women tend to not be the first one to jump in and say what they think. You know, they tend to let the men speak first. And, you know, it's just little things like that. But I think that, you know, sort of the awareness and getting a forum together for discussion is a really important thing for law firms to do and have.
Tracy?
We also have formal and informal mentoring programs. Our formal program is actually kind of interesting. It's what we call our professional development program. And as part of that, every associate has to draft a professional development plan, and they're assigned a partner mentor. You meet with quarterly, and you go over your plan. Are you is your plan good? Are you meeting your plan, you know, expectations? And the plan is great, aside from the mentoring, because it really allows you to take charge of your own career in a way. And, but the mentoring is also excellent. We change probably, you know, you can ask for the same partner, but they encourage switching so you can get a variety of different views on what you're doing and what your goals and aspirations are. But also, I completely agree that the informal mentoring is it's just terrific. I mean, I just got back from maternity leave in December, and before that I was going to lunches with the Stork group because there were so many pregnant women at Hogan and Hartson this year. And it was great. I mean, it was, you know, it made me really feel connected to the firm. And while I was out, there were emails going around between these women. And then there are other things as well. The Women's Initiative sponsors dinners at women partners' homes, and there are, you know, book discussion groups and things like that as well. And it's just all of these forums, you know, what's nice is that there are so many and that you can pick and choose on what really fits you. But I would just stress that the informal mentoring is just awesome. It's critical.
And the other piece of that mentoring is your value as an individual in being an effective mentee. I think there's a lot of focus on what firms can deliver in terms of mentoring program, but a mentoring relationship is based on two people having a connection and both benefiting from the relationship. So to the extent that you can offer something to the person you want to be mentored by, that's going to be a much more positive relationship and a much more sustained one, because that person has an interest as well. And you don't think as a law student entering a law firm that you could actually contribute value to these relationships, but a lot of these people really are looking for wisdom, whether they're on the recruiting committee and you may be able to offer insights on this law school or law students generally, all those sorts of things. You got to think about what you can deliver in return.
Voluntary
question.
You're right.
Are your firms coming back on programs in 2009? And also, do you feel as women hold you have a good support group from the men in your firms, if any support group from the men, you have a good support group from the men?
Why don't we start, who wants to start with this sort of the economic downturn, and we'll mix up these questions a little bit. Somebody want to start with that?
I don't think we've seen any cutback in the programs yet. You know, I think we're all still sort of feeling out what this year is going to look like. And, you know, everyone's a little cautious and thinking maybe we're going to need to tighten the belts, but I don't think we're seeing it quite yet. But I do think sort of the general economic situation is that, you know, maybe our summer associate programs won't be quite as lavish as they've been in the past, just because it just feels obnoxious this year to do things, you know, that are too outrageous.
Does anyone want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's right. And there are, I think you will see a lot of firms being more thoughtful about how they spend their money, both in terms of amount and in appearances, and I think that's appropriate. You know, I'm not aware of
wholesale cuts, and certainly at our firm on, gee, we're not hiring summer associates or things like that because we need people to come and do the work. But I don't know what we're going to see out of this economic climate, and it bears watching. For in a number of ways, I think, not just firms specifically, but on pressure on the business model from clients who are now looking to law firms to bear some of their pain and things like that. So we're just beginning to see what pressures we're going to come under from various sources.
I think, and I'll just echo that. I'm seeing that most of the programs and systems in place at these sorts of firms are already in place. It's all about scale and how those programs and events are executed, and it's really been ratcheted down in terms of scale, and it's much more tempered as it is appropriate. But in terms of the actual events taking place and things like that, I do see them still in place, which is heartening.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to give a fancy Christmas party when your client just canceled their fancy Christmas party. It's that kind of to the point you were making, really, about not only amount but appearances as well.
Right. Being in good taste.
Yes.
What about this notion of engaging men as champions for women? I just recently did a program on this. Maureen, do you want to comment on that?
Well, I'm not sure that, as far as the firm goes, we've done anything formally in that regard. Although, I know that it recently came up where it's important to have men be sensitive to issues, just in terms of dealing with junior associates and but I don't think anything formally. I mean, I know that I have enjoyed mentoring relationships with senior partners who were men, and I just didn't think about the gender when I sought out advice and work from senior attorneys. So I don't have much to say about that.
Tracy, do you want to add anything? And sorry, I'll go to you in a minute, Sarah. About men really getting invested in this, how have you seen that work effectively?
Yeah, I haven't experienced a problem with having men be great mentors. I've certainly had terrific mentors who happen to have been men. I guess the only other thing that I would really add here is that I think that the firm does support, I mean, it's only in the firm's best interest for everybody to support these kinds of policies. And in fact, I'm sure this is the case with everybody here, like the reduced hour, reduced time policies are across the board. You don't have to be a woman to qualify. You can be a man. You don't have to have a child to qualify. And in fact, when I first started at the firm, there was a male associate who was reduced hours, and he didn't have kids. And it was like, wow, that's great. So I just think it's in the firm's best interest to have everybody on board, and I haven't experienced any issue with men being less supportive of these kinds of arrangements.
Sarah, do you want to add?
Well, what I was going to say is that in these situations, I've found it, when I've talked to men about the male mentor I have about my reduced schedule, they look at me like, why are you even making this an issue? I don't care as long as you get your work done. And to me, it's sort of, and this is going to sound bad, but it goes to the point we're making, which is maybe not thinking like a woman and feeling bad, but thinking like a man and being like, fine, I'll just get my work done and I'll respond to your question, and you don't care where I am, I don't care where you are. And that's kind of this, instead of feeling bad and taking it on myself to, this pressure that I'm not being enough or not being it, I've just sort of put it off the table. And I think that men maybe more traditionally were doing that. Mm-hmm. I think women now are doing that, which has made it a little bit easier as well. So I find that men, I guess to answer your question, have been supportive in that I sort of look at them as a role model as well as women, and how to deal with pressures from, a lot of, most of the men I work with have children at home or have something at home that they're wanting to get to as well, and they don't care if they're not at the office. And so instead of feeling bad, I just handle it that way, similar to the women. So it's a little different perspective, I guess.
Yeah, I think also the men who seem to be most engaged are those who have some personal reason to be that way. I mean, I recently had in this program this Engaging Men as Champions for Women program. One of the panelists was a senior male partner at one of the top New York City law firms, and he has three daughters. And that really, you know, he says, you know, that changes the perspective for me, because now it's my personal agenda to make these environments more women friendly, because I want my daughters to succeed. So I do find when it's a personal investment that something's triggered with that person that's made it more personal for them, they are more effective generally.
I think all of you are mothers. How are the programs at your firm, all these programs, are they open to people who want to have reduced hours but are not parents? Or do they, you know, are you required to say, well, I need reduced hours because I'm going to have a child? And are people who don't have families are not and are on a reduced schedule, are they treated a little bit differently? Or is this just as long as you want to have a life outside of work and that's fine?
Well, I can. As I mentioned, the policy doesn't sort of discriminate in that way, and I hadn't had the experience of going in and saying I want to be reduced hours, and period, you know. But I think that it's possible to do that. I mean, you can say I have interest outside. I only want to be here 80% or whatever it is. And in fact, I think that's what this male associate that I was referencing, what he did. He just didn't want to be full time. But I think part of that equation is, and I think we've all referenced this before, is, you know, you've got to sort of build up your value to the firm. And, you know, if you're the go-to person on something, they're going to, you know, the firm's going to want to keep you. And they're going to want to make it, you know, possible for you to be happy. And if what makes you happy is working 80%, then, you know, it's a no-brainer kind of.
I think one thing that's important is distinguishing reduced hours and punching the clock. Really, to be effective working reduced hours, let's say a 60 to 80% schedule is most typical, you're staffed on proportionally fewer matters, but you're still on those matters 100% of the time. So what you're gaining is flexibility and ideally fewer crises because you're staffed on proportionally fewer matters. But I don't want there to be a misconception that, you know, you're just sort of on call or off call. I think truthfully, that's the greatest source of dissatisfaction I see with lawyers working reduced hours, is that you gain, you know, more freedom with the hours in your week, but you're still not gaining predictability. So it's important to just, you know, when you have to be responsive and accessible, you're the point person on the client, you're still 100%, you're just staffed on proportionally fewer matters. And I think if you are concerned with delivering top-notch work, and you're responsive and accessible, like Sarah was talking about, then you're okay, because you're meeting clients and colleagues' demands, and you're also meeting your own needs. But the emphasis really has to be on flexibility rather than predictability, or else it really won't be successful in the current law firm environment. Does anybody want to add to that point?
Yeah. You know, I don't want to say this in a harsh way, but I sort of stick by my earlier point that if you're negotiating for some flexibility, you know, going in there and proving your worth first and establishing your niche and establishing your value is an important thing to do. But, and this ties in a little bit with the question about interviews and things like that, if you're looking at big firm practice, it is challenging, it is demanding, and if people are going to big firm practice saying, I want the big firm practice, but I just don't want to work very hard, there is a disconnect there, and you have to listen to that disconnect. And if that's really where your heart is, then the fit between what you want and your chosen law firm may not actually be very good. I do not want anybody in this room to walk away and say, oh, gee, Covington is hostile too. It is not true. We have a lot of people at partner and associate and counsel levels who work on reduced hour schedules. And it's very well accepted. It's done for different reasons, to write a book and things like that. But I do worry about the brand new lawyer walking in the door to big law firm where they still haven't really learned the practice of law and saying, but I don't really want to do this, that to work that hard, because it is demanding. And we'd be lying to you if we told you otherwise. It's hard work.
Other questions? I guess I want to just probably end with this last question about challenges. I started with this slideshow, which has a lot of sobering facts, that your firms are among the best, but there's clearly a lot more work to get done. And I want each of you to think about and give us a sense of what are the biggest challenges in making those changes? What remains in the biggest challenges?
Well, for me, I think that the biggest challenge is really taking the time to take advantage of all of the groups, the lunches that bring women together and try to bring them forward in the law firm environment. It's really easy to just sort of be that worker bee you were referring to and just try to, for me, I'm working, I'm trying to get home to see my kids, I'm working. And so, sort of pulling away and trying to create the relationships that, the mentoring relationships, the dialogue that will, advance the causes you're talking about.
Yeah, and I think that whole notion of understanding that really critical to your success are those other components and not just thinking you just have to deliver the work is a constant reminder that women in particular have to have in their head. Maria?
I think we touched on this, but law firm life is difficult. It's challenging. The thing we can't fix are client needs. The clients have needs, you have to deliver, and sometimes it's crises. I think training clients a little bit to be, developing good relationships with clients is critical because I'll lay down on the tracks for my clients when they need me because they respect me and my time and they're trying to treat me like they want to be treated. And I think a lot of that is training clients, but that can't always be the case. And some of it is very much practice dependent as well. You can look at different types of practice areas, even within law firms. Some are a little bit more sane than others. And, that wasn't really something I thought about when I was choosing a practice area, but it's true. But law firm life is challenging, and I think flex time is a great way to sort of make the best of it. But it's not a 9-to-5 job. I don't think it ever will be. But it's a great job, and it's very challenging and interesting. And I wouldn't trade it in for anything. But there are certain things that I think are just fundamental that I'm not sure we can ever fix, but we can do the best with what we have.
Yeah, I think, that you mentioned the idea of practice areas, and people always ask me, what's the practice area I should go into, particularly law students? And I get really wary of that question because the last thing I want to do is create these pink ghettos where all the women are in trust and estates where the client's dead and it's not stressing. I think that, so that's why as an advocate on these issues, I'm trying to push change within the organization. But separating out the nature of the practice as being often uncontrollable is different than the environment that could be more hospitable. And I think, and the individual and how good each of you are at managing your time, the environment that you end up selecting and your individual ability to manage your time are the key areas of focus. And I think that, that client pressure or the nature of the practice pressure is something that's the hardest to change. Tracy.
I think a big challenge to getting over these issues is talking about the perceptions that people have, or talking about what is valuable to you as a person, being reduced hours, full-time, whatever, what's important to you in your life, and getting over the perception that it's not okay to have interests elsewhere. I think, I know from my perspective, before I had kids, it was like, am I the one that's going to have to stay late because I don't have kids, but isn't my date with my husband just as important as getting home to my two babies, actually? I think what would be nice is if, and this happens in these mentoring groups, and I just point that out, is that people talk about what's going on in their lives, and you realize, this person, this is really important to them, and if they tell you, I've got to go to my Pilates class, it may sound silly, but for that person, that's their measure of sanity. And that should be okay. Obviously client needs come first, but sometimes people miss the idea that it doesn't have to be done tomorrow, and maybe that's okay, And so I think that working with the perceptions and getting sort of the word out and allowing people to be themselves is important to dealing with some of these work-life balance issues.
Yeah, and I think that what you're getting at also is this notion of stigma, which is huge, and value judgments being placed on how people want to allocate their time outside the office. And trying to get the focus more to be that this is a good lawyer who's delivering good work and is responsive and accessible, and their choices outside the office hopefully will become increasingly less relevant to what they're delivering,
right,
delivering at work. Maria Luisa, excuse me.
I want to mention something we touched on earlier but hasn't really come up in this, because we're sort of looking at, you know, the institution. And we talked earlier about how a lot of women law students just don't see gender as an issue. And I think by not seeing that, now again, I'm bringing to this the lens of, you know, 20 years of law practice when gender was a much more overt issue when I started. It's still there. And I think one of the big challenges is that male lawyers and female lawyers don't get that. And there are a lot of times where women shoot themselves in the foot because they volunteer to, you know, go pick up the tabs from supply, or to do, in the team meeting, they'll take on the job that nobody else wants to do because it's scut work and somebody else is going to get it. Or, you know, they don't recognize a discrepancy in the way they and other people are being treated. They don't advocate for themselves. They don't solicit mentors. They apologize for their opinions on conference calls. These are all things that women do. And so, in a way, a lot of folks are carrying a lot of these challenges, and you kind of need to turn the lens on yourself and see how you're contributing to it, as well as all of the bad things that institutions do. But there are things that women bring to the table that they need to examine carefully.
But that's really an excellent point. And I think, you know, another tension is among women, which I usually don't bring up in a mixed audience, but women making different choices and embracing the diversity within themselves and bridging the gap, which I'm seeing most acute now, between baby boomer women partners and Gen Y women, and them, you know, saying, well, wait, these aren't role models that I identify with, and that sort of thing, is that those women who have killed themselves to get to the top are being misunderstood often by the younger generation, or they're misunderstanding the junior lawyers coming through the ranks. So that's another issue that I see coming into play that can be a real impediment. And of course, another reason to also draw from the experience of the men, but also for women to think more about, you know, respecting their role models and realizing they can learn some things from them and not everything from them necessarily. Sarah?
Well, I think the final thing that I noticed with your presentation was just how many women actually leave law firms. You know, we start so high, and I think one of the challenges that women are having is just hanging on and sticking through and finding a schedule that works for them, and whether it be full-time, part-time, or, you know, switching to maybe not the partnership track, and just hanging on and staying at a law firm. And then once you get the past the years where maybe you wanted more time at home or less time at home or whatever it may be, switching to another, you know, just hanging on and staying at a law firm and then becoming a leader at your firm, even if you're not, you know, fully, a full-time partner at the firm, whatever it may be. I always find it, it's disheartening when I see those numbers. Having, as I said, I started as one of 15 women. I think we're down to like 7 or 8 of us now, but I mean, I'm hoping, you know, some of the rest of us hang on till the end. But, you know, the pressure as a 6-year to go in house is huge. So I mean, and it's very, it looks great, but I think that as firms start to have these conversations and change their culture, I hope that more women can sort of hang on and make it to where your partners have made it.
Right, and some firms are
just the end. It just keeps going.
I think some firms are looking at more nonlinear career paths, at least for a period of time, to help bridge those difficult transition years, so that it's not this up and out type of thing,
right,
and that there are abilities for women to stay on more and not go all, either stay home entirely or mm-hmm. go to in-house or government or not-for-profit. And so that's something I think to consider too. But the notion of staying in the game and keeping your hand in it is so much more important than leaving entirely and then getting back, which is, you know, a permanent pay penalty and a lot of associated challenges. Are there any other questions? Does the panel want to add anything else? Well, I want to thank you guys for listening, and I want to thank Tracy Jenkins for bringing us here and putting together this program. Thank our panel for a terrific job, and we hope to see you well employed soon and engaged and happy as lawyers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.